Today's episode is made possible by Affinity Solutions. Unlock your business's potential with actionable insights into consumer spending, powered by Affinity Solutions. With exclusive insights from over 140 million cards, Affinity Solutions showcases consumer purchase behavior with unprecedented clarity. Seize the opportunity to reshape your strategy with accuracy, execute with precision, and measure with confidence. Affinity Solutions equips you to outperform in today's competitive landscape. Step into the future of analytics with Affinity Solutions today. Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers Weekly Listen, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Affinity Solutions. This is the Friday show that has two Christmas trees. Did I hear that correctly, Stephanie?
Oh, wow, you were listening that whole time.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's right. Always listening to you guys talking smack about me. When I walked away.
You sound like a wiretap.
Yeah, two Christmas, maybe. Two Christmas trees. How many is too many? Six?
I mean, it depends. Like, if Macy's has six, like, that seems like an appropriate amount. You know what I mean?
For a house. Six is
probably
too many.
Depends on the square footage of the house, too,
yeah,
right?
Exactly, like, yeah.
If you've got six.
That Home Alone house would probably use two or three, but...
That's true.
If you had two or three in my apartment, that'd be maddening.
No, that would be a lot. There's an indoor forest. Anyway, I'm your host, Marcus Johnson. In today's show, can Twitter come back from its most recent situation?
You know, maybe Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, crater so bad that Musk will eventually sell, or investors will force him to sell, and a new management can take it over and do better than they're doing.
Will folks buy cars on Amazon?
It's got worse in recent times. It's not always perceived as a high quality environment for making purchases, so that will be the potential barrier.
Are ad-free social networks inevitable?
I imagine there would be a trickle-down impact on ad rates dropping, and then subscriptions becoming an ultimately bigger slice of a revenue, so I just don't think it's viable in the long term.
Are we ruining buy one, get one free? United Airlines weighs using passenger data to sell targeted ads. And we talk a little bit about tipping in America. Join me for this episode. We have three people. Let's meet them. We start with our vice president of Everything Briefing. She is based in New Jersey. It's Stephanie Taglianetti.
Ahoy, mate.
Oh, nautical.
It's well early. Got to keep you on your toes.
Yeah, I know. I was expecting the traditional greeting.
Exactly.
Well played. We're also joined by one of our senior analysts on the digital advertising and media team based, where are you, Ross? Just above New York City. It's Ross Benish.
Hey, Marcus.
Hey, chap. We're also joined by, across the pond, back in my home country, on the south coast of England, our principal analyst who covers everything UK and dabbles in a little bit of Europe too on the weekends. It's Bill Fisher.
Good day to you, Marcus.
There he is. Also host of our Behind the Numbers Around the World show. So they're the three people we have for you. What do we have in store? Three people, three segments. We start with the story of the week. Of course, we're talking about Twitter and its latest debacle. We then move to the game of the week. Our contestants will try to win the championship belt. We end with some random trivia for segment three. But let's start, of course, with the story of the week. Can Twitter come back from this latest situation? Many advertisers have halted spending on X, formerly Twitter. We'll, of course, use them interchangeably, as everyone does, in growing backlash against Musk, writes Kate Conger and Tiffany Sue of the New York Times, noting that Warner Brothers Discovery, Apple, Sony, Disney, Comcast have all joined other companies in pausing spending on the social media platform over Elon Musk's endorsement of an anti-Semitic post. Also, X just filed a lawsuit against Media Matters, a left-leaning advocacy organization that said it found anti-Semitic content on the platform and highlighted ads for Apple and IBM and other brands that appeared alongside pro-Nazi content. X is accusing the group of wrongfully attacking the company's right to free speech. So that's where we find ourselves. Ross, I'll start with you, mate. What do you think of its current situation and whether Twitter can recover from it?
Well, its current situation is pretty bleak. They're obviously going to have a big drop in ad revenue and a big drop in users. The platform's become even harder to use. A lot of the features that used to be common for Twitter are now only available for paid subscribers. I do think they could come back, but probably under new management. I'm not super hopeful of what Musk turning around, but you know, if you look at like Yahoo, when they were owned by Verizon, they seemed like a dead company. And they were sold to a private equity. And usually a company sold to private equity isn't good for those companies. But Yahoo's doing actually not what they used to be in the early 2000s, but they're doing a lot better than they were under Verizon. So, you know, maybe Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, crater is so bad that Musk will eventually sell or investors will force him to sell. And a new management can take it over and do better than they're doing. That's my most optimistic version of this.
Oh, gosh, most optimistic. That's rough. Well, so a sale of the company is its best chance of survival. There is a chance that Linda Yaccarino could leave, who is the current CEO of X. That could really tip the scales. Axios was reporting brand chiefs and marketing leaders have reached out to the CEO to push her to resign. And Lou Pascalis, who's founder and CEO of marketing consultancy AJL Advisory and former head of global media at Bank of America, said he texted Miss Yaccarino urging her to leave. Senior folks have urged her to leave, hoping that she can before her reputation is damaged, saying the issue is no longer about content adjacencies or content moderation. It's simply that the owner, Mr. Musk, is not someone marketers can do business with. So yeah, to your point, Ross, maybe he has to go for advertisers to be comfortable doing business with him again. I mean, we have to address the latest news, which is that X's owner, Elon Musk, just told advertisers who are boycotting the platform this quote. So he said, "I hope they don't advertise. If someone is going to blackmail me for money, then go, you know what, yourself. Don't advertise." And he said, he actually swore on stage, but I'm not going to do that here. He said, "Don't advertise. What this advertising boycott is going to do is it's going to kill the company." Ross, how big of a deal do you think this is in the grand scheme of everything that's going on?
Well, it's a big deal in that it's just going to further discourage large advertisers from appearing on X. In Business Insider, Laura O'Reilly's article, she theorized that Musk is trying to sabotage X because that would actually make it less valuable and reduce the interest payments that he owes to creditors who helped him make the deal. In the rebooting, Brian Morrissey theorized that this is basically his call to arms to say that he's done with advertising and he doesn't want to be seen as the person who killed X. This is a pre-planned comment. He is trying to shift the blame and make the brands the villain to all of his followers.
That last bit was my take, is blaming advertisers so that when things go worse or he has to file for bankruptcy or whatever ends up happening at the end, he can say, "Well, I did what I can." Blame the advertisers because they're the ones who
He directly said, like, this is killing the company.
Yeah,
and he kept reiterating it. And, you know, the big brands don't have to be on Twitter. Like, it's not a must buy. A lot of brands have already left it. It's not like Amazon or Google where it's something that they can't avoid. It's very easy for them to avoid. You'll see some political advertisers over the course of the next year that will come on board, but I don't think this is that hard of a boycott for these brands to maintain.
No, it's not that big a part of their budget. It's not that big a part of the digital advertising budgets in the US. I think it was just over 1% of the dollars were going to Twitter, to X, before all of this happened. Now we have it at about 0.5%. So it's not a big, it's not a
tall order. It's not worth the controversy that like you may be inviting when you have the CEO going on stage and chastising you.
Yep.
Well, just like in the last day, he's sharing like crazy Pizzagate stories. Like it's not just the anti-Semitic stuff. There's like every day there's just some new wild thing that you wouldn't expect a CEO of a company of that size to push.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, advertising is in bad shape as well when Comcast/NBCU has pulled their ad spending, because that's where Miss Yaccarino used to work as the head of advertising and partnerships. So having a pretty strong relationship with that company, having them pull advertising is not ideal.
I'm in line with Ross. I think it's Musk. Musk needs to go. And ever since he's taken over the platform, brands have been pulling away due to brand safety concerns. I think we lower our forecast due to brand safety concerns. We lowered it. Twitter's ad revenues to $2.98 billion, down from $4.74. Ross can probably gut check me too.
Well, and I bet there could be another adjustment downward in the spring. Like I don't think that's the final downward adjustment.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Ad revenues. So we had last year we had them, so they posted $2.4 billion. US ad revenues this year, $1 billion is what we're expecting, which would be a 55% drop. And the company seems to agree with that. Mr. Musk recently saying that US ad revenues are down 60%. And he said that each of the last couple of months. So that's not going great advertising wise. Also, if you take a look at the top advertisers, if you take the top 100, as of October of 2022, only 50 of those 100 have stuck around. The other half have stopped spending on the platform, according to Sensor Tower. And most of the brands who have returned are spending less on the platform, according to Sensor Tower as well. Internal documents reviewed by the New York Times suggesting X could lose as much as $75 million in ad revenue by the end of the year as a result of all of this. X disputes those figures. Bill, where do you land on this?
Echo what the other guys have said. I mean, it all comes down to one man, I think. I thought the Media Matters thing is interesting.
Yeah.
And the language he used about them, he called them an evil organization, which, well, it typifies the sort of man he is. But it reminded me of an interview he did with the BBC not long after he bought the company. And he likened Twitter to the BBC and suggested that neither of them should be the arbiter of what constituted misinformation.
Huh.
But then by the same hand, he went ahead and reinstated loads of previously banned accounts that absolutely have been peddling misinformation and hate speech. So it's no wonder that brands and advertisers are wary of spending on the platform, right?
Yeah. Yes. So what is actually in dispute here with regards to Media Matters? X actually admits that one of the posts that Media Matters has pointed to did violate content moderation rules, but they allege that Media Matters manipulated the service to make X serve the offending ad. In fairness to X, though, they're not the only social platform that is struggling with a flood of misinformation, particularly now, you know, shortly after the war going on in Israel and Gaza. Ryan Mack of the New York Times is writing, social media platforms in general have faced rising scrutiny since Hamas attacked Israel and Israel retaliated. Anti-Semitic and Islamophobic hate speech has surged across the sites and has been especially prominent on X, according to the Anti-Defamation League and researchers. Final thing from me, this would be Mr. Musk's reach is also a real problem here, because this would be bad if you endorse this post and you had this anti-Semitic post and you had no followers. It would be awful. If you had one follower, it would be even more awful. He has 163 million followers, the most of anyone on the platform. Just in case you're wondering, Obama's second and Bieber's third. Justin, look at that. What an odd top three. Anyway, we'll keep an eye on this story, I'm sure, and see where we land. That's what we've got time for. For the story of the week, though, let's move, folks, to the game of the week. Today's game, it's really the only one we play. What's the point? I read out four stories and contestants give us their best take on the story. Okay answers get 1 point. Good answers get two. And answers, they give you the same feeling as when you wake up with over an hour before your actual alarm goes off and you realize you still have more time to sleep.
No, it's better to just sleep that hour.
What?
Than wake up. Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah, it's not good.
Ross? Unanimous?
I would also agree. Oh. I wake up a lot sooner than I want to now with either the dog or the infant.
I actually find it annoying when I do that.
Well, when you wake up too much, I think there's a sweet spot. If you wake up with like 10 minutes before, it's like, oh, that's not enough.
10 minutes would be nice.
Four hours is fine. Yeah, yeah.
10 minutes is fine?
10 minutes is fine, but an hour is like, I really wish I was sleeping.
Yeah, I agree with Steph.
All right, never mind. Answers that leave you with the same feeling as when you accidentally discover a keyboard shortcut. Still nothing? Tough crowd. Okay, fair enough.
We'll give it to you.
Answers that give you the same feeling as six Christmas trees. Yes, yeah, we're back.
Okay. Yay.
Answers that leave you, it's too many. Answers that leave you with that feeling, they get you 3 points. You get 20 seconds to answer before you hear this noise. Do it again. The bell. Only the worst people run long. Do it twice. And I'll give you the silent treatment. I probably won't. We need to talk to each other. Most points.
So who's
wins.
Running long right now, Marcus?
Say, so, yeah, I kind of want to run long.
No. Okay. That wasn't an incentive. So you don't have to talk to me anymore. Let's go on with the game. We start with Stephanie for round one. Will folks buy cars on Amazon? Shoppers will be able to buy cars on Amazon next year, starting with around 15 Hyundai dealerships, writes our retail analyst Rachel Wolf. Customers can search based on location, model, color, features, etc., and can check out on Amazon using their chosen payment and financing options. They can pick up their new car themselves or have the local dealership deliver it at a convenient time, Rachel notes. But Stephanie, will folks start to buy cars on Amazon? What's the point?
Yeah, I think they definitely will. Car shopping is probably the worst experience ever. And it's not like this is something novel that Amazon is pioneering. However, I think the biggest hurdle that's actually going to happen here is the number of states that inhibit car dealers from selling D2C or have laws currently pending. I think like half of the states in the U.S. have laws that ban D2C car sales or severely limit those sorts of sales. So I actually think that might be a big barrier.
Interesting. Bill.
Yeah, I'm with Steph. It's not a stretch to imagine they might. During the pandemic, of course, big ticket purchasing almost became normalized, didn't it? I think the issue that Amazon will have is perception. So buying a vehicle from a trusted brand is fine, but buying from a platform where you can also buy questionable electronics from a questionable third-party vendor is a bit more of a stretch, right? Obviously, in this case, Amazon's working with a big auto brand, Hyundai, in this instance, but there's still this perception attached to the platform, which I think we've spoken about on the podcast before. It's got worse in recent times. It's not always perceived as a high-quality environment for making purchases, so that will be the potential barrier.
Mm-hmm. Oh, where's the bell? There it is. Ross.
It makes sense that they're doing it because they're sell everything, and this is one of the few things they don't sell, and online car sales have become more common. I'm skeptical Amazon's going to become a leader in this space, though. You know, sites like cars.com or Carvana, Auto Trader will hold a first mover advantage. And Amazon's expanded into other areas like healthcare, where they don't just completely dominate it. So I get why they're doing it, but I don't expect them to overtake the space.
Yeah, looking at the space, Ross, you mentioned online car sales becoming more common. Our forecasting team think 5% of auto and parts, the auto and parts market, 5% of that is done online. That doesn't sound like much. That's good enough for a $79 billion business. It's growing pretty fast as well. For context, $79 billion is nearly as much as food and beverage online sales. So it's not nothing. Let's move to our second round. We start with Bill. Are ad-free social networks inevitable? Snapchat is testing a new paid subscription plan for Snapchat Plus in Australia that offers users a mostly ad-free experience for about $11 a month. Right, so our senior director of briefings, Jeremy Goldman, he notes that this move marks a shift in how the platform has made money. Facebook and Instagram are also now offering an ad-free tier in the EU for about $14 a month in response to upcoming privacy legislation. Jeremy says this development and similar moves could set a precedent for how social media platforms balance ad-based revenues with user experience. But Bill, are ad-free social networks inevitable?
I think they are as an option, but I don't think they're going to materially change user behavior. So you spoke about Snapchat Plus. I think there are 5 million Snapchat Plus users globally. That's a very small proportion of the global user base, about 1%. Even if you look at something like LinkedIn Premium, and that's a, you know, LinkedIn's an entirely different proposition where subscriptions are more accepted. Even that, it only accounts for about 6% of the global user base. So from a European perspective, I can understand why these platforms are bringing in paid ad-free tiers. It's to try and get around regulatory scrutiny, but they'll continue to bring in most of their revenues from advertising because consumer behavior won't change that much.
Mm. Ross.
I wouldn't say they're inevitable because it's unclear if there'll be enough people to sign up for some of these services to make them a viable option.
Oh, there we are. Brief, but good point. Stephanie.
Yeah, I think Jeremy raised a good point, Ross, as well, and how viable would this strategy be long term, because social media companies are very dependent on ad sales for monetization. And then when you lose the ability to send personalized ads, I imagine there would be a trickle down impact on ad rates dropping and then subscriptions becoming an ultimately bigger slice of revenue. So I just don't think it's viable in the long term.
Mm. So there is YouTube Premium, which YouTube, not, you know, kind of traditional social networks, more social media, but they have, yeah, so YouTube Premium, which does offer ad-free viewing or listening, but they also offer, you can download videos to watch later, you can play things in the background, you can, like turn your phone off and still be listening to music, you can stream music as well, so there's YouTube Music that it comes with. So it's hard to know if people are subscribed to that just for the the no ads. I did, and I'm sure some people did. 80 million YouTube Premium folks worldwide. So there is that, but yeah, there are other perks there. So who knows why people signed up in the first place? Maybe it wasn't because of being ad free. It's only 80 million compared to the billions of people who use social platforms for free.
And also, like, longer form video and audio probably makes more sense, right?
Good point. Yeah, really good point. Halfway mark, Stephanie just out in front with 5 billion. Ross tied with 4 in second place. Joint last. Round 3. We start with Ross. Are we ruining buy one, get one free? Kate Dayton of the Wall Street Journal writes that marketers' race for data is leading to buy one, get one deals that make customers work a little bit harder. She gives the example of customers who order a Domino's pizza online under its emergency pizza promo, have to collect their promised free second pie in a subsequent online order in the next one, and also belong to the company's loyalty program to participate at all. So Stephanie, are we ruining buy one, get one free deals that were a lot more simple, it would seem? What's the point?
I mean, did we really think we'd get away with free things with no strings attached forever, Marcus? I think it's actually very creative loyalty tactics, whether it's about forcing someone to join your loyalty program for the perk or leaning into a comedic marketing tactic. However, I personally think, would somebody download an app for a buy one, get one deal? Yes. And then would they delete the app after cashing in on the deal? Also, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how sticky it is.
Bill.
Yeah, I'm going to go UK specific. I've got 6 large grocery chains in my town that I can shop at. Each of them have their own loyalty scheme, which if I go into their store, they're dangling in front of me. If you're a loyalty member, you can have this free or whatever, you know, buy one, get one free. But 6 is too many. I don't have membership with all of them. So I actually avoid going to stores where I'm not a member because it reminds me too much what I'm missing out on. Obviously, it's driving great loyalty for the stores where I am a member. But I even feel quite annoyed at them that I can only get the deals there in return for my data, essentially. So I get it, but I don't like it.
Most things in life. Get it, don't love it. Ross?
This has been happening for a while, so it's not exactly new, but we are ruining it because we're making more promotions about trickery and attrition than rather giving customer value. But that's just the way things are going.
Mm. Oh, optimistic. All right.
Yep, as always.
Are you in a rocking chair right now, Ross?
It does have a rocking feature.
Yeah, okay.
it's an office chair that rocks.
Okay.
It's not like a wooden, you know, rocking chair from the early Appalachian.
1900s. That's saying you're just picturing you in the
sitting on my grandma's rocking chair.
That's just
I'm actually sewing with my hands here, too.
That's where we find ourselves. what are we up to next? Round 4. Let's do that. Round 4. Double points. Round 4. All to play for. Still really close. Stephanie just out in front still by 1 point. And we start with Stephanie for this last round. United Airlines ways using passenger data to sell targeted ads. Right. Have we done this story already? No, we haven't. If we have, we're doing it again. Right, it's Patience Hagen of the Wall Street Journal. Come up with something new. She explains that some of these targeted ads could appear on its in-flight entertainment system or on the app folks use to book tickets and check in. But Stephanie, you're up first. United Airlines weighing using passenger data to sell targeted ads. What's the point?
It makes sense. I think that personalized travel ads based off of your travel history or your current location in particular would work really well. But if this isn't common practice with airlines, I could see consumer backlash being enough of a reason to go ahead and fly with another airline, at least right away, you know, while this is starting off.
Yep. Bill.
Yeah, I don't know. What is the backlash going to be so long as, you know, the airlines are following regulatory guidelines and
right.
about data collection and sharing? How annoyed is someone going to be that they're getting served a particular ad based on their flying habits? I don't know. Is it going to impact their flight choice in future? I just go for the cheaper flight. That's going to
Correct.
Be what drives me.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll let Ross go, then I'll have a take. Go on. Ross, sorry.
Well, everything's become an ad network now. I mean, you know, whether you're getting like a taxi service or I was at Walgreens getting a flu shot and the person behind me was complaining that they had to use the app to make the appointment and all the app did was serve them targeted ads and they hated getting targeting ads just to make a flu shot appointment. So there's a lot of inventory being unlocked with these new retail ad networks and this is now happening with airlines, but I think they just make the experience of being a customer more annoying. And I really hope bidets don't get screens, because then they'll turn into an ad network too. There's no limit to what will turn into an ad network.
Did you say bidet?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
You just wait. It's give it 5 years.
So the personalized ads thing on a plane, it depends what they're serving you. If it's an embarrassing ad, then it could be a problem, because we all watch the TV screens of our neighbors on the airplanes. Like, I was rewatched The Social Network on my flight 2 days ago. Great film. But I was also very glad that the chap just in front of me had the Monday Night Football game on, which you don't need the sound for. So I was also paying attention to that. When he moved his head in front of it, I pushed it back. I went, out of the way, please. I'm trying to watch that. But we all look over each other's shoulders and see what everyone's... So, I mean, ads are quicker, you know, than an hour and a half long movie. But I wonder if that's going to irk people somewhat. All right, that's all we've got time for. No, actually, well, two more points, actually, I did want to mention. One, there's an audience. United has the fourth largest airline worldwide by passenger count. Something like 130-odd million people who they fly every year.
And you're not going anywhere when you're on that plane.
No, you're stuck.
Yes, exactly.
You can't get out.
You can't. Tell the people who jump up when the seatbelt light comes off for no reason whatsoever. And then second point here is others are doing the same. Miss Hagen notes that last year Marriott started letting advertisers buy personalized ads on hotel room TV sets in its app and emails based on the hotel chain's customer data. Marriott's loyalty program had 164 million members when the ad business launched last year. All right, that's what we've got time for this episode. No.
No?
No, it's not. We've still got a whole other segment.
There's more.
So we've got time for the game of the week. Please don't leave yet. So we've got time for the game of the week. Count the scores. This week's winner, Stephanie!
Hey.
This week's winner of the game of the week. 11 points. Hey. Bill and Ross, 10 apiece.
Nice.
So very close. Wow, very close.
That
very
was close. Closer than I thought it
call,
was.
Close call, y'all.
Yeah. Stephanie, you get the championship belt and the last word that no one ever wants.
Yeah, because we never know. We're never prepared for this.
But
moment.
You should just have something in the back pocket.
So
you know?
I will talk about
here we
something.
Are.
If you are in the New York City metro area, I highly recommend that you see the musical Shucked. I saw it over the weekend. It is a comedy musical about corn, lots of corn puns, and it closes January 15th, so your time is running out to catch it. Winner of several Tony Awards as well.
Use promo code Stephanie.
Use promo code Stephanie and you will get a red error message.
Yeah, you probably will. Don't do that. Very good, very good. Congratulations to you. You win the game of the week. Let's move to our final segment. It's, of course, dinner party data. This is the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing we've learned this week. Or scramble for something to say, because we haven't really prepared. Normally Bill. Sometimes Ross, actually. Most people.
Oftentimes me.
I'm always prepared.
Yeah, everyone not called Stephanie. Stephanie, you're up first.
So if you want me to start while the
yeah,
two of you look on Google for some random factoids, I'm happy to do that.
You're up.
So I wanted to talk about Thanksgiving data now that it's coming out, since we're after the holiday and Cyber Week. And I think that some of the spending data that came out should be a signal for some continued strong holiday spending throughout the next few weeks. So according to Reuters, U.S. shoppers spent around $38 billion online for Thanksgiving. That's up from $35 billion last year. Online consumer spending jumped around 8%. Year on year during Cyber Week, more than 200 million shoppers made purchases both in-store and online during Thanksgiving weekend, which is a 2% increase over last year. I thought this was interesting. So a record $940 million worth of purchases were made through buy now, pay later on Cyber Monday. And that's almost 43% higher than last year. I think that's a really, really big number to shout out. Mm. And 200 million people, or more than 60% of the U.S. population, shopped over the 5 days from Thanksgiving to Black Friday through Cyber Monday, which trumped last year's record of 196.7 million shoppers, according to NRF.
Okay, Stephanie, that's interesting stuff. This is normally the segment that it's not work related. So
it's like the new Nicole.
She is like Nicole. Nicole did do this for years. What's happening?
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Did you not?
I usually have something silly, but I was actually curious about this.
Some people probably are.
Thanksgiving.
We normally.
Oh my gosh.
We normally have some kind of obscure wrestling fact from Ross. Or I talk about the highest grossing horror film. Something ridiculous.
Ross?
I haven't gotten anything on wrestling today, but I'll think about that.
All right, never mind. So let's move straight to Bill. No, go on, Ross. What you got for us?
Well, Stephanie brought up Shuck, the musical about corn. So let me talk to you about the Nebraska Cornhusker football team.
What are the chances
of this? And they just ended their season on Black Friday. And I just want to talk about what's happened over the last 3 years. So they've played 36 games over the last 3 years. 19 games decided by one score. They've lost 17 of those 19 games. It's the most in college football. So they won just 2 one-score games. So 90% of one-score games, they lose. Let's go back a little further to 2018 when Scott Frost became head coach after they fired Mike Riley. There was 28 one-score games with 3 games that went into overtime. So that means there were 31 times where they were tied or trailed on the last possession. And of those 31 times, just 3 times did Nebraska score on those last possessions, and just 1 time got the win because those others they lost in overtime. So they have about a 10% score rate and a 3% win rate when you get down to the last possession of games that are tied or they're down by one score. Their opponents on their last possession score more than half the time, and they win damn near every one of those games. It's the reverse of losing 17 of 19, including 3 walk-off field goals this year and an overtime touchdown against Wisconsin. This is all just in 1 year that they've lost 4 of these games this way. So my point with all this is athletic director Trev Alberts, kill the program. It sucks. They're terrible. It wastes money. And it's a poorer experience for fans than Twitter is for advertisers. So Husker fans are old Yeller with rabies. Just put us out of our misery.
Okay, yeah. He mentioned it at the end there. For context,
such passion.
Ross is, he went to Nebraska, in case you guys could. It'd be funny if he didn't.
It was a
rough
Black Friday.
It'd be so funny if Ross went
Friday.
To like Princeton and couldn't care less about this, but just needed to get it
I
out.
Actually saw their last win in person. I happened to be back in Nebraska, and they beat Purdue, and things looked like they were good. We're 5-3, and then we lost 4 one-score games in a row to end the season and to continue our misery for our 7th consecutive losing season, the most in FBS football.
Yeah, that's rough.
Yep, sure is.
Get it together, Nebraska. Bill, you're up.
I'm going to leapfrog off Steph, actually. She was talking about Thanksgiving. I'm going to talk about Christmas, or at least the Christmas month. I have a fact about December. So it's the last month of the year. Obviously, the 12th month in the Gregorian calendar, which is what we use. But it used to be the last and 10th month of the year in the early Roman calendar, hence deci, as in 10. And this early Roman calendar was wild. Came about in 738 BC. The year started in March, and 6 months had 30 days in them. 4 months had 31 days in them. So if you're any good at mathematics, you'll know that only adds up to 304 days. So there was a mysterious winter gap where time apparently didn't exist. Anyway, things got even more messed up as the years went by. Months got added and moved around, but they never quite got the length of the year right until Julius Caesar came along in around 46 BC and sorted all that out, left us with what has been a pretty enduring Julian calendar. And it only needed a slight tweak by Pope Gregory the 13th in 1582, because they figured out that Easter was kind of drifting through the year a little bit too much, and they came up with leap years. Caesar hadn't accounted for that. So they skipped 10 days out of the year to bring us back into the line, and that's where the Gregorian calendar comes from.
So with Gregory, when they skipped those days, did they just retcon it and like those 10 days didn't happen?
They disappeared, yeah. You could.
What if you murdered someone or like, count. You know, didn't count?
What a time. Very nice, Bill. I've got one for you real quick. We're talking about tipping in America. So, according to an August Pew Research study, a number of things. One of the things was most folks think tipping is spreading. It certainly feels that way, in the States at least. I've got five facts for you about tipping. One, Americans are more likely to see tipping as an obligation than they do as a choice. 29% said obligation, 21% said choice. Two, tipping habits vary across services. When asked, when do you always tip? Most, 81%, said yes to eating at a sit-down restaurant with servers. 78% always tip when getting a haircut. 76% when getting food delivered. 70% at a bar. 61% in a cab. 25% when getting a coffee. And 7% at a restaurant with no servers. That's interesting, because if 81% said yes to always sitting down. Oh, I guess it was, that was always. There were some folks, which means, I think it was about 5% of people who said, no, they don't, ever.
Huh.
Yeah, that's quite surprising. Three, most, 57% of Americans say they tip 15% or less for an average meal at a sit-down restaurant. So it's not that 20% that I think it seems to be what I thought was kind of standard practice. But yeah, most people saying 15% or less. That could have changed over the years. Four, what are tipping decisions based on? Most say quality, 95%. But 50 to 60% of folks also say these three things. How much the tip will cost them, how much the worker earns. I don't know how they know that. And social pressure as well. So they're the reasons that people decide to tip. And then five, the average person is being asked for tips about five times a week, and over half of people are getting tired of it, according to a new survey by tech supplier PopMenu. That last one comes from them. How do you guys feel about tipping?
I covered this, Marcus, in Around the World earlier this year.
In the US? Oh, tipping around the world?
No, around the world. So yeah. the various countries where tipping is not expected.
Mm.
Australia, New Zealand, it's not expected, I don't think. And in some countries, if you tip, it's seen as quite offensive as well.
Huh. So yeah. Interesting.
In the UK, every time I go back, I try to tip. And anyone I'm having dinner with is always like, enough, stop it. It's not a thing anymore, right? It used to be 10%, now it's nothing. Because I guess they get a living wage, not a minimum wage.
Right, right.
They're paid more.
I don't know who your friends are, Marcus, but it's still a thing.
The worst
it's
people.
Still a thing.
He just hangs out with people.
Yeah, I know. He's cheap. All right, I need to talk to them.
Marcus's friends.
Yeah, oof, I know. It's a rough bunch. I'm trying to buy new ones. So only seven states mandate that all workers, regardless of tips, must be paid the full state minimum wage before tips, according to the US Department of Labor. So every other state, apart from these seven, the federal minimum wage for tipped workers is $2.13. The main federal minimum is $7.25.
Wow,
that's not moved for the last 15 years. Yeah,
$2.
And those folks, a lot of people will say, oh, well, they make a lot in tips and you can make up that money. In the US, servers make a median average of about $100 in tips a day, depending on different factors and the state they're working in. In 2021, the median income for tipped American workers was $12.50 an hour, according to the US Bureau of Labor Statistics. What the hell are we doing? How do you guys, in the US, Ross and Stephanie, tipping?
Well, I tip knowing these facts about how those workers are being compensated if I do not tip them.
Yeah.
I do tip a minimum 20% knowing, and then I do above that if people give extraordinary work. But I did recently go to a hair salon that was tipless, and it was nice knowing that those folks were making livable wages that didn't require the tipping. So yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, when you know these things about workers, you have to tip them. That's their livelihood.
Yeah. Ross?
Depends on what the service is. I mean, if it's a sit-down restaurant, generally 20%. If I'm getting takeout from that same restaurant and the thing asks me for a tip, I don't tip anything because no one's actually serving me. I'm just grabbing the food and going myself.
iPads at Starbucks.
Yeah, they ask for it. I'm like, well, I didn't sit here. I didn't, like, no one actually served me. I didn't use your restroom. I didn't do anything. You know, I have a cab service in town that's local. If I, like, go to the airport and they have a all-inclusive fee that they say includes tip, and mm-hmm. they'll break out how much goes to the driver. So there I won't tip. But if I'm, like, getting a New York City yellow cab, I will tip. So you know, it always depends on what service you're doing and how you're doing it.
Yeah.
You know, even at a bar, like, if I'm just grabbing a Bud Light, I probably won't tip because the guy literally just handed me a can. But if he made me a margarita or she made me margarita, I'd give a tip because mm-hmm. there's actually, like, more involved there.
Yeah. It's so interesting how everyone has their own set of rules that are kind of slightly similar, but
yeah, it's very arbitrary,
quite different. Yeah, we're actually going to institute tipping on this podcast, so if you guys want to donate to some money to me as the host, I'll send around my Venmo. Because Marcus needs a new winter jacket.
We're good.
Yeah. We're good, Stuart, if you could forward that to Ross, Stephanie, and Bill, I'd appreciate that. That's what we've got time for this episode. Thank you so much to my guests for tipping. Thank you to Ross.
Thanks, Marcus.
Thank you to Stephanie.
Thanks. You won't see me in your Venmo.
And thank you. Okay. Think about it. All right. At least let it marinate. Thank you to Bill.
Always a pleasure.
Yes, indeed. Thank you to Victoria, who edits the show, James, who copy edits it, Stuart, who runs the team, Sophie, who does our social media, and Danny, who helps us out with video things, and Lance, too. Thanks to everyone for listening in. You can find us on Instagram at Insider Intelligence. That's one word for all the behind-the-scenes content you can possibly want to consume. We'll see you guys hopefully on Monday for the Behind the Numbers Daily. That's an e-marketer podcast made possible by Affinity Solutions. Happy weekends.